listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hollywood, this is your host of the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into this episode. We have producer, drummer, recording, mixing engineer extraordinaire, Mr. Sean P. Jones. How are you, Sean?
I'm doing great. You also forgot a dog daddy over
here. Dog dad. I was like, Dad, wait a minute. Yeah.
No, just the dog dad right now.
Come on, Max. I love that you got the LA Dodgers hat, man. That is the official team of the city we live in, so I love it.
It is. Yeah, it's also because I've not gotten a haircut in the last couple of months, and I'm getting a haircut here later this week, but this is just a quick way to deal with it.
Hey, that, you know, we're lucky that we can just do that, throw a quick hat on. I don't have enough hair to really have a terrible hair day, but you know what? We do what we can. We do what we can with what we got.
Exactly.
So how are you, dude?
I'm doing great for the most part, just nursing myself of an injury this past week. But, other than that, doing well, keeping busy, staying busy, you know, and feeling blessed to be doing what I do.
You know, I thought I had the Princess Leia headphones for the first episode of Sight and Sound, but you just said, your headphones said, hold my beer, here are the Princess Leia headphones. I love them, dude.
Well, Nikki, these are the ones I was telling you about. They're the Odyssey LCDX, and I got into a little bit of a headphone craze earlier this year, and these are the ones that I finally ultimately picked up. And
that's absolutely crazy. Love them. I think you're looking at the wrong camera. You're looking at the wrong camera on purpose. Yeah, there you go.
Well, so my screen is right here, but then
if you want to look that way,
weird. I can do that too.
Do you have a separate camera than the screen?
Yes, so this is my my system that I have for the tech company that I work up. So I have the camera over there, so I could kind of gaze off that way. So then this way, I don't have to stare at your face.
I thought you were just ignoring me. Yeah. I thought we were in a fight.
No.
I was like, wait a minute. So you hail all the way from Nebraska. What's the city in Nebraska that you're from?
I'm from Lincoln, Nebraska, and if anyone remembers the Capitals game, that's the capital of Nebraska. I grew up there, lived there for the first 18 years of my life, and then I went to school in Texas, specifically North Texas, to study jazz drum set. Then after being out there for 7 years, I decided to make the move out to Los Angeles, for which I've been here ever since.
So are you a Cornhuskers fan? Isn't that where the Nebraska Cornhuskers are from?
I was a Cornhuskers fan back in the 90s when we were good, or I should say they were good. But since I went to college and kind of moved out here, you know, it's worked out well for me. They've not been very good for the last 20 years, and I haven't had time to watch.
I've always wanted to go to a Cornhuskers game, so now I have to go with you since you're actually from there. You know what I mean? We have to catch a game because it's on my list.
Why specifically is that on your list as someone who went to USC?
So I love all college football sports, and especially football. And I think one of the things that is really cool is you can go to different stadiums and see all these different schools play. I want to see a Duke basketball game. I want to see a Villanova basketball game. I want to see a Cornhuskers football game. I want to see a USC Notre Dame game at Notre Dame, except I know we'd have to win. It would be so hard for me to travel all that way, and then for us to not win, it would be devastating. So the part of the allure with sports, I think in general, is when you love a team, you love traveling with that team or seeing other teams, you know, compete in their arenas, because like they're iconic. Like Cornhusker fans are part of the experience, and I know you know this. because yeah. they're crazy and they have like the full body paint with the corn husks and the whole bit. Like, you got to experience that kind of stuff once, you know. It's like going to like a Green Bay Packers game. I want to do it at least once, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I get it. Or like going to a Dodgers game. It's like, you know, you don't understand the history until you go there and you see that stadium.
And I, you know, I recently went to wasn't that recent, about 3 or 4 years ago for a bachelor party, we went to a Red Sox game. And like seeing a game at Fenway, I'm like, I'm never going to be a Red Sox or a Celtics fan, but it's kind of cool to just go to their these historic, you know, stadiums to see the sports team. So the Nebraska Cornhuskers, they have an iconic stadium and an experience. So it's like, you just have to do that. But let's talk about you going to UNT for a little bit, because my drummer also went there. Don Henley went there. It's a very reputable music school. What was that experience like for you? Was it kind of like, oh my goodness, this is crazy? Or did you enjoy the experience? What was the best thing you got out of the experience?
Well, there's, you know, so many great things that I got out of the experience. For me, it was, you know, a little bit more background about my upbringing in Nebraska. Both my parents are professional musicians. But even having said that, they were at like kind of the top of the totem pole there of what you could do being a professional musician. And I was already,
where they play.
My father's a classical percussionist. So he played in the both symphony orchestras there in Nebraska. So the Lincoln Symphony and Omaha Symphony Orchestra. And my mom was a church organist and choir director and also taught piano.
So that's where you get your ear from. 'Cause a lot of drummers, you don't always have the kind of like musical ear. They have the rhythmic ear, but you have the musical ear as well. That's where that comes from.
I would say yes. I mean, definitely that helped, of course, a lot, you know, but I'm also going to give a lot of credit to where credit's due of the school that I went to at North Texas as well, too. It was an incredibly high-powered jazz school, to where there was kind of a hierarchy of getting into specific, you know, lab bands at that time. And it was really good to just be an incredibly competitive environment. And I took a lot out of that. But one of the biggest takeaways for me from the music side of everything is that they had a hierarchy of the bands that you could be in from the 1 o'clock to the 9 o'clock. And when I first started out, I didn't make any lab band at all. Wow. But my second semester, I made the 7 o'clock, and then I was, wow, you know, trying so hard to make the 1 o'clock, and I was in the 2 o'clock for a while, and I kind of realized that I was never going to be in the 1 o'clock unless I politically kind of played the game of what it would be with the director and being popular with the other members in the band, because that was a big thing about it, too. And for me, that was also just a really good life learning thing, because it's like, you could be the best player, but in the real world, that doesn't matter. It's more about, I don't want to say just politics, but who you know,
no, it's
being in the right circles.
No, you and I talk about this all the time. Yeah. We talk about this all the time. There's so much of that at play. And it's kind of funny that you got a taste of that in music school, where they should shield you from that kind of stuff. But it's just there. It's always there. It's like, it's almost there in some ways more potently than it is in the real world sometimes, because it's such a small community, you know?
Yeah, it's the, I mean, that's one of the most unfortunate things. I think that it's great that colleges are a meritocracy at some level, but I feel that they also do a disservice to their students if they don't explain that in the real world, a meritocracy does not exist.
Right.
Even in, quote, the blind auditions at like a symphony orchestra, it's still not an actual meritocracy. There's a lot of politics that goes into who makes what chair and who's winning the audition. So it's like, I feel it's really important that people just kind of embrace that and just kind of, you know, that thing that, you know, it's like you and I talk about all the time of like, in the real world, it isn't fair. It isn't fair who gets certain gigs. And a lot of times who gets the gig that you want really doesn't have anything to do with how good they are as a player, or if they're better than you or worse than you. There's just a lot of other things away from that that you can't control. And right, the minute I feel that you accept that, you know, your lack of getting some sort of gig has nothing to do with your self-worth as a whatever profession you do, it's kind of liberating.
Right.
It makes you just feel empowered. Like, well, this is just what it is. And it's just the the happen circumstance of what it is.
Yeah, it's funny too, because you know, you and I talk about this all the time, but it's like in the music industry, there's so much industry that's like using drugs and drinking and like making that the thing. And it's like, if you're not partaking in that, you kind of like oust yourself. And it's really silly because it's like, yo, this should have nothing to do with music. It's like, it's like the fun part, but it's like has nothing to do with anything musical. Like there's nothing musical about any of that stuff. You know what I mean? It's fun. Yeah. It's extraneous, but it has nothing to do with music and ability. And that plays a lot into how musicians are dealt with, or, you know, and it's like, it's crazy. It's really weird how it works like that. But you came out of the music industry, you came out of UNT, and then you drove out here to California. What was kind of your first kind of, you know, impression of what Los Angeles was like for you?
Well, before I get into that, maybe I should just give a quick briefer of how I got into recording at
UNT,
because that is kind of important and integral to the story of even why I came out to L.A. One of the benefits of the school that I went to, it was a huge music school. I think there was close to 2,000 people in the music school, around 400 people in the jazz studies program that I was involved in. But there was no recording arts program at all at the school.
Wow.
And so because of that, I was kind of an entrepreneur at the time. And I just got like an audio interface and I started recording a bunch of the jazz recitals. And then I kind of turned it into a business. And then all the money I was making, I was pouring back into more gear and more equipment. And so while at school, after I graduated, my plan was to move to New York to try to become like a touring drummer and do some of this different stuff. And then I had a mentor at the time in Texas that said, he saw my face just kind of light up when I started talking about recording equipment. And he's like, no, you need to move out to LA. And you need to kind of go out there to experience that. So that was kind of the reason why then I moved out to L.A. Moving out to L.A., Max, calm down there, bud.
Yeah, sorry, Max, little, chill out, buddy.
Yeah, exactly. Moving out to L.A., it was a different time. It's so weird to say it even now, but it was a different time when I moved out here. It would have been like 12 years ago now at this point. And it really has changed a lot since then, because even as unaffordable as it was back then, it was still somewhat affordable back when I moved here 12 years ago. Whereas like now I couldn't even possibly think about moving out to a place like this with how completely unaffordable it is. But it was just like a crazy thing of like moving to the big city. I remember when I first got out here, I'd only ever lived in Lincoln, Nebraska, which was about 250,000 people, and then Denton, which was maybe 100,000 people. And it was close to the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, but it wasn't like L.A., where it was just sprawling city everywhere you would go. And I remember when I first moved out here, and this was like right when iPhones were, you know, kind of becoming the thing, we had handheld GPS. I was just like, I'm going to be lost forever. I don't know how to get around. Like, what is it? Like, none of this makes sense. And then, you know, after a while, it's like my roommate at the time was like, no, dude, you'll figure it out. It's all going to be fine. So then, once I moved out here, it was just genuinely a feeling of being incredibly overwhelmed just by the sheer mass of everything that is here. But then also just like kind of immediately falling into the love and the allure of what Los Angeles is, of, you know, the kind of the glitz and the glamour and the different fun things that you can do out here that were never opened up to me when I was in Dallas.
And also the amount of artists that are just like everywhere. It's like,
yeah,
you can't round a corner without seeing an actor or actress or musician or producer or, you know, singer or painter, whatever it is. It's like everybody is doing something artistic on some level or working in the industry on some level, because it's all here. So that part of it is kind of interesting because it creates an identity. Like I'm from here, and I always tell people that have, you know, moved out here, I find it so commendable when people are like, I'm gonna pack up all my stuff and move to this crazy city, because it is a circus. It's like not as much of a circus as New York, but it is still very much a circus, very much like New York. But it's like you're leaving like all the things you know, all the people you know, to come to this place that you're unfamiliar with, and it's just like you have to like learn the layers. Like I tell you this all the time, like LA is in all these layers, and you learn the bullshitters from the schmoozers, from the like, oh yeah, these are like the, this is like family crew kind of people.
Yeah.
But it, you have to go through the schmoozers and the bullshitters first. Those are always the first people you meet. And you're like, oh yeah, this person's legit. And then you're like, no, yeah, this person's not legit at all. This is crazy. Yeah. So I'm sure you had some of that. But what did you like kind of like jump into as far as the music scene? Did you start playing first? Did you start recording first?
It was very interesting. I kind of got locked into a couple of scenes pretty quickly. I knew that I didn't want to ultimately tour like that because that was kind of away from my long-term goal of what I wanted to do. And so within the first 6 months, I actually landed as a player, as a drummer, a house gig at a steakhouse in Beverly Hills. And that's playing. Yeah, exactly.
The steakhouse.
And I was playing there 4 nights a week. And so that was just kind of keeping my drum chops like honed. And then during the day, I kind of started networking and, you know, doing recording sessions and working with different people. And it's kind of that weird thing because it's like I probably stayed at the steakhouse a little bit longer than what I should. I had a good run there being, you know, 6.5 years at 4 nights a week. But it was really good to just get a really good financial base underneath me.
Right.
While also just kind of setting up the recording contacts and different things like that, and just kind of really starting to understand what's going on in the industry. I think I've told this story on here before, but like I remember it was at that same time, it's right when I moved out here, I kind of had the option to go on tour with a really, really high profile singer pop artist that is now absolutely huge.
Yep.
And or I could work at the steakhouse. And I remember that artist would just treated me and the other people in the band and everyone like crap. And I was just like, man, it's not about, for me, I kind of made like a thing. It's like, it's not about who you work with. It's about how you get treated. And that was where I was just like, I'd rather just stay here. And there's been other tons of great opportunities and I don't regret it at all. You know?
Right. We won't name that artist. But yeah. If I gave a hint of what the name rhymed with, then people would be like, what? But I don't think people would be surprised. I don't think people would be surprised.
No, I don't think they are.
And you initially met Ethan Carlson, which is how we met, at Stagg Street, right? You started working at Stagg Street?
Yep, exactly. So there's a great recording studio up in Van Nuys that I started just first as technically it would have been a runner. You know, that I had a connection to that studio and that I very quickly became a assistant. And then one of the engineers there that they would hire, there was another kind of like lead engineer there named Ethan Carlson, who he had a recording studio in, he rented a recording studio space in Studio City and I had a bunch of gear and he's like, well, hey man, do you want to share the space with me? And I'm like, sure. So we shared that space for, I think, 3 or 4 years together before he bought a house and moved his studio up to his house. And then I kind of, you know, kept the studio there for an additional, I'd say about 3 to 4 years until I just
that's where I got my Glockenspiel credit with the Christmas
song. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
that's forever one of my favorite credits because it's not every day you get to play a Glockenspiel on a recording, but it's on that recording, was in that room. So that room always has nothing but love for me for getting that credit.
And that room is now a dermatology office as well, too, Mickey. You know, I mean, that's
crazy.
Yeah, it's, you know, one of the other things that's unfortunate about this thing, I've now been around long enough to see that the studios kind of come and go. And it's just like it's a different thing now. So so now I just have this recording space this is in my condo at home. And I just set up a nice mixing room that I can also do some tracking and things here as well, too.
Well,
that's great. No one bothers me.
Let's play something. What do you want to play first?
Of the three tracks that we had? Let's do What was the I did the La Raca Flaca one. That was something I produced. And what were the other? There's yours as well, yep, too. 40 yep. Days, 40 Nights. Yep. What was the last one that I sent you?
I got to look over here. Hold on a second. Sam could tell me if he sees it, but let me see if I have it. Hold on a second. I have Johnny Orlando.
Oh, yeah. We could maybe do Johnny Orlando first. This is something. It's a little bit old now, but this was a project that I miss is like kind of what I'm doing, just like straight pop stuff.
And this you recorded it, you mixed it, a little above.
So I mixed this track. So this was kind of just like my bread and butter mixes track from another guy that I work with a bunch named Federico Vinver, who he's a great producer that has kind of gotten connected to Timbaland's team, and so I've worked with him a bunch doing some different mixes over the years. So.
Here's Johnny Orlando mixed by Sean P. Jones.
About all the things that we shouldn't talk about. Those kind of words that will change all the things we talk about. Tell me, do you ever think of us? Should I ask some more or should I stop? What if our tomorrow means that we are here together? Or what if we are taking chances just to lose it all? Really crazy thinking about this all together. Or if I've been missing the writing on the wall. What if I say, I know, you know. What if I told you I like you? We stay, we go. What if I told you I like you? What if I told you I like you? What if I told you I like you? I hear everything you're saying about us. It's not about right or wrong, it's about what we love. Be simple or would it be too complicated? Should I keep going or maybe it's better to stop? What if our tomorrow means that we are here together? Or what if we are taking chances just to lose it all? Am I really crazy thinking about this all together? Or have I been missing the writing on the wall? What if I told you I like you? We stay, we go. What if I told you I like you? I know, you know. What if I told you I like you? We stay, we go. What if I told you I like you? What if I told you I like you? If I told you I like you, we stay, we go. What if I told you I like you? I know, you know. What if I told you I like you? We stay, we go. What if I told you I like you? What if
Very cool. How could you not like that song? It's just infectious, dude.
Yeah, I mean, Fetty's such a great producer. I guess I was trying to think of, like, why did I pick this song? I'm like, oh, yeah, this was probably one of the most streamed songs that I've ever mixed. I was just looking at some of the numbers, and it's like close to 200 million on Spotify.
That's amazing.
And yeah, I think like 100 million on YouTube, and you know, probably another 150 or something on Apple Music. So
was it in a movie? I saw it look like movie credits at the end.
No, so it's, I mean, this is an interesting topic that we can talk about too, of just how the world has changed. Of like, both Johnny Orlando and Mackenzie, those two singers in there. They're basically social media stars, and they were kind of like on the first wave of TikTok and, you know, Instagram, and they were really young when they, you know, kind of got found. So it's like, because of that, they just have like that built-in audience, you know, when it comes to having a lot of people listening to the music. So
well, it's, and how old were they? Were they in like high school in that, or were
they, at that age? I think they were maybe, I think Johnny was 14 or 15 at that point. So really young.
I was I was like, man, I have this theory that like people that are older than you, like let's say you're a sophomore or freshman in high school and you look at the seniors, they look so much older.
Yeah.
And when you look at people behind you, they look so much younger. So I'm like, these kids, they look way too young to be college kids. I'm like, maybe high school. But I'm like, man, even high school, there's moments where they look like they're in like 16, 17. There's moments they look like they're 12. You know, I'm like,
yeah, exactly.
So, but I mean, it's such an great mix, by the way, like super pop.
Thank you.
Super like really lush. You can hear the Bieber influence on the track. I can tell like what the producer was listening to, what they were listening to, as far as like vocal licks and stuff, you can hear that Bieber influence big time, but it's really, really pop friendly. Just like you, it's just really infectious, cool groove, and like you just can't not like it. It's just one of those tunes. It's just orchestrated and built so well and mixed so well too that you just can't not like it. I loved it. It was great. Great mix. Did you have any problems mixing that? Was it like a tuning issue or were like effects like not behaving?
That was one of the one of the reasons I like working with Fetty so much, and maybe he'll hear this hopefully more and, you know, give me more work because I love, but like his stuff that he gives me sounds so good that I have to work really hard to make it sound better. So in the process of working hard to make it sound better, I have to become way better at my craft. And so that's my favorite person to like work with is like, man, like this already. And like, by that I say, it's like, it already sounds so good. How do I get it to that next, you know, 5 to 10%? And the funny thing is I feel that like in our world and in the best of the best of, let's say specifically the mixers, that's why you get paid the really big bucks. You get paid the really big bucks to make it that extra 5 to 10%. It's not like it sounds at, you know, 20% and you have to get it up to 80. It's like, no, they give you a track that's at 95%. And you're getting paid all that money to make it sound 5% better. And it's really hard to make it sound 5%
better. Well, it's like there's so much of it, which I love too. This is what I love about pop music. It's like there's so much layering, like in what they're doing with the synths and what they're doing with the drum sounds and the vocals, that it is like people hear it and they think it's like, oh, it's pretty easy. It's so detailed. And it's so subtly detailed that it is a fine art, I think, to make a proper pop song and have it hit and have all the things that need it to hit, you know, the characteristics. So I'm not surprised that it got 200 million, you know, on Spotify, because that makes total sense, you know?
And just one quick question. Can we, we're on live on radio. Is that correct?
Yep.
So no cursing is what
you can curse. No, you can curse. Yeah.
I just want to make
say fuck and shit and all of that.
Okay. Okay. Well, because the thing I was going to say is like the older I've got into, the more and more I've got into mixing, it's realizing how I get something to sound good by not fucking with it.
Right.
Like, you know, and that's like the hard thing too. I feel, especially in anything that you do in the creative technical side, whether that's producing or engineering or writing, it's like, wait, just because I can doesn't mean I should. So it's like, a lot of the, let's say, mixes and things that I'm working on now, I won't even add an EQ unless I really need to. You know, whereas like back when I first started, it's like, well, I have to EQ everything. Where it's like, well, now it's like, do I really need to EQ this? Or am I trying to justify why I'm getting paid? You know, I mean, like, that's like a big thing of like, you know, just because you have that color on your canvas does not mean that you have to use it.
Yeah.
You know? If it doesn't actually serve the art of what you're doing. And that's taken me years. And I'm still learning that as well, too, of like me not trying to mess with stuff just for the sake of messing with it.
I think that is the restraint. I think that is spoken like a true veteran, because I find that like I can play the most noodly thing and it just doesn't move me. And the thing that moves me is when I show restraint and I try to play less and I try to sing less and I just sing enough that makes the track, or play enough that makes the track do its thing. And I think the same thing with mixing. It's like, yeah, you can show off all the cartwheels, but that just makes me roll my eyes instead of like, wow, this is really good. It pulled me in. It seems like it's easy, and it's not easy. So I think that restraint is that like next level thing, which you pulled off, you know?
Yeah. And with that, I'm kind of thinking another reason why I picked this, the three different songs I picked too, is because they kind of accurately showcase my three different mixing approaches. And that is this is like the first one. And none of these approaches is correct or incorrect. It's only correct or incorrect with the context of what you're working with specifically the producer or the artist.
Right.
And so with this one, I got a mix and I got paid to work on it to make it just sound sonically better. All of those delays and effects that you heard on there, I didn't come up with. That was something the producer already had there. And so he gave me the work to be like, I need you to check all the work that I've done to make it just sound better. Clean everything up.
Yeah.
And that's where it can be really difficult. And here's the problem is why you can lose gigs is because you'll get that. And then you'll start doing your own things. You'll start putting your own reverbs or delays on there. You'll send it back to them like, no, what are you doing? We like the way that it sounded. Why are you messing with this?
Right.
You know? And then another way to mix is, which I don't know if we want to go into the other song, but it's, and this works out well for me because this is something that I produced as well and mixed, but that's where it's like, I'm taking my own artistic liberties with it to where it's like, I'm adding my own reverbs, my own delays, you know, the track, it's by LaRocca Flocka, that I'm also very happy to see that even when I looked on this track, I think has, I think it was close to 100,000 streams on Spotify, which is great for an independent artist.
Right.
And this was kind of me modeling like a modern, you know, artsy pop from the 90s type thing. We actually have like an instrumental section in the center that I hired this great drummer that still lives in Texas that went to my school to play some drums on it. And it was just kind of like me messing around with different sounds and just, you know, trying to, it was more of like me taking an artistic approach to mix.
Let me ask you, why didn't you want to play that part?
The drum part specifically? Yeah. Because I knew that my, a couple reasons. Number one, I don't have an adequate recording space to do it in an efficient way. And I'm also, I feel at a level now to where I felt that, you know, objectively, this drummer, Matt Young, could have done a better job quicker than what I could have done for the service of the music. So it's like, just because I can play drums doesn't mean that my ego means that I have to play drums.
But that's what's, that's like another mature decision. It's like, play for the music or use the choice for the music. And then it's like, oh, yeah, that's going to serve the music better. So I respect that decision. That's why I wanted to ask. Let's play this song and then we'll talk about it. LaRocca Flocka, is that right?
Yeah, correct.
This is LaRocca Flocka, produced and mixed by Sean P. Jones. Oh,
Mr. Sun, Sun, Mr. Golden Sun, come out and shine down on me. Oh, Mr. Sun, Sun, you're the only one that can make me feel this free. You cure my heartache from the rain. Just one look takes away all the pain and cleanse my soul when I'm in need. You're the only light I wanna see. I brighten up when I'm with you. Everything gets better that I do. I'm on my bones and clear my head. Dry any tears that I shed. Mr. Sun, Sun, Mr. Golden Sun, come out and shine down on me. Oh, Mr. Sun, Sun, you're the only one that can make me feel this free. You give me strength when I feel weak. Hear me out when I just need to speak. And lift my spirit up so high. All I need are your rays to survive. I breathe you in as you're coming out. I have never had one little doubt. Your words have helped me pave the way. Hate to watch you leave, wish you could stay forever. Sun, Sun, Mr. Golden Sun, come out and shine down on me. Oh, Mr. Sun, Sun, you're the only one that can make me feel this free. That can make me feel this free. That can make me feel this free. You heal my heartache from the pain. You give me strength when I feel weak. I breathe you in as you're coming out. Mr. Sun, Mr. Sun, you're the only one.
Mr. Sun, Sun, Mr. Golden Sun, come out and shine down on me.
Very cool. I like that tune a lot. Production's good, man. I love that piano. The octave that you chose for the piano is great too.
Like, thank you. That was actually a different track than what I thought it was going to be, but it is a La Rocca track. That was the first single that I did from her, and that one actually got a fair amount of streams as well too. But in terms of that, one thing I should also mention in that is I actually had another producer work on that with me as well too. That was so that wasn't just 100% me. And so a lot of times when I produce songs, I also like to bring in other people. There's a guy I work with a bunch named JP Warner, who's about 10 years younger than me, that I love working with him because, like, we just bounce ideas off of each other, and we're never, each of us are never sacred to our ideas, to where it's like he'll maybe scratch something I did, put something else on, and then I'll listen to all his ideas and scratch. It's like there's no ego involved. And so it works, you know, really well working with him, kind of getting these productions to the next level.
That's awesome. And was she like on a label? Was it like a manufacturer? They wanted to kind of like make her into a star, or was it like part of a...
No, this is all completely independent. An artist that I kind of connected with over Instagram, and she just takes her music career pretty seriously and really wants to get good, high-quality songs produced. And as you can see as well, too, having like a video done with it as well, too, which I think is so important these days for anyone that's trying to do the music career, is just unfortunately, now you have to do all of it. You know, it seems, including being your own PR firm and marketing team.
Oh my God.
Until you get to a certain level.
You hear me complain about that more than anybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's funny because those people closest to me, they hear me. A lot of people are like, man, you're always so positive. And I'm like, well, you haven't heard me complain.
Get on a call when you're on a call with Sean, you know? And then we're just like, and one more thing that sucks, you know?
Well, you know, it's the music industry is not for the light of hearts.
And no.
Not for the faint of hearts. And it's also, it's just got these weird conundrums and situations that you know this, and I know this too, that you're put in situations sometimes where you're like, what the fuck? Like this.
Yeah.
And the reason that I love working with somebody like you and working with my band members is there's none of that. It's just like, it's like a bunch of friends that happen to also be talented and love working together. And I'm like, this is what I love most about this team and this project that we're doing with Sight and Sound is like, this deserves all of those views that all those Indian pop artists get because it just is on a level. There's something about it. So
was that a remark at Bollywood right there? Did you say the Indian pop artists?
No. I just said indie pop
artists. I thought you said Indian pop artists. I was like, well,
I have my gripes about
that. Gauntlet was thrown down.
And you know what? Coachella, I don't know if I told you this. I saw a lot of Indian like artists at Coachella.
It's popping off.
And I was like, this is really okay. It's not holy shit, but you see people like being pulled in like, oh, it's ethnic.
It's not like K-pop to me.
Right.
You know, it's like, it makes sense why Bollywood and there is such a huge Indian music scene just based on the sheer demographics of.
Right.
Is it like 1.2 billion people?
Oh, it's 1.2. You know? Actually, it just, they say that, you know, I saw something on, you know, that said 1.4, but it topped China, so it's over 1.6.
Okay, really?
It's the largest country in the world, you know?
And now I'm about to completely speak out of my ass, but it seems like Chinese don't have that market because it seems like K-pop really kind of controls the Asian, you know, the Far East Asian when it comes to like that type of market in terms of modern popular music.
Like a united front. I think that has a lot to do with like India, you know, the Bollywood scene is actually more profitable and bigger than the Hollywood scene. Like I'm talking
about,
which to me is crazy because it's like, you know, and I, you know that I'm like in these Indians and entertainment groups and like they talk to me about Bollywood movies and I'm like, never seen it. And they'll mention a Bollywood actor. I'm like, don't know him. Like it just never was on my radar. But it's like this whole underworld of art and content that I'm just like not interested in as much because a lot of it's really cheesy to me, but some of it's really good, you know? So
it's, well, I mean, that brings up a big concept that I know that we've talked about at some level, but it's just the days of monolithic culture are over now.
Right.
To where, you know, I played you a song earlier, that Johnny Orlando song that has 200 million streams on Spotify.
And you've never heard of it. 7 million streams on YouTube.
Yeah, exactly. Right? And it's just like it has that many, you know, million streams and you've never heard of it. Right? And like that's something that's objectively a lot of people are listening to. Or I just think about my own, you know, ignorance a little bit to where it's like, you know, but of course, like who can know it? Like I literally had never heard of Mr. Beast until, you know, I heard someone talking about him on a podcast and I'm like, no, I never heard of Mr. Beast until it's like, you know, don't judge me out there. Wake up Hollywood. But I listen and I watch, Joe Rogan. Yeah. I watch Joe Rogan. Okay. Don't cancel me.
Right.
And Joe Rogan had Mr. Beast on, right? And I'm like, who is this guy? Like, I've never heard of him. And then I look him up his YouTube, and his YouTube at that time had like 100 million followers.
He's the biggest, of all of them.
He's the second business right now.
Oh, okay.
There's an Indian thing that's bigger. Yeah. But again, it's one of those things where it's like, I didn't know the second largest YouTube channel. I had not heard of it. And it just shows how like in a monolithic, like we don't have a monolithic culture. Whereas back in the 90s, everyone knew who Brad Pitt and Ben Affleck and Matt Damon were.
Right.
You know, or Leonardo DiCaprio.
Right. Like,
everyone knew who they were.
Well, and it's also steering too. I think it's like it's veering in, because, like, you know, Memorial Day movies were like huge.
Yeah.
Even just last year, and this year they weren't. Like, nobody cares, and it's strange to me. I'm like, wow, this is a bizarre world we're living in, you know?
Well, that's where it's just like, I love the, you know, the mindset now that, you know, it's kind of the, I believe, is it Jack Conte that created what was the platform we created? But, you know, it's kind of the model of, like, now you don't need to have, you know, 50 million fans. But if you have, you know, 500 fans that are deathly loyal and they all give you $100 a year.
Are you talking Patreon? You know, is that
Patreon? Yeah. Yeah. But that idea of you have 500 fans that all of them, each of you give you $100 a year, that's $50,000 a year.
Right.
You know,
right.
And that's all you need. And, you know, or maybe, you know, twice as that, maybe 1,000 fans. Right. You know,
it's funny. I've wondered with Sight and Sound. I'm like, oh, I should just put this on Patreon and not ever publish it. But it's like, there's a part of me, it's like, yo, isn't the point just to, like, spread it to as many people as possible? Like, you don't know how it's going to impact somebody. Maybe somebody's having a shitty day and they hear something like this. Yeah. That's what art really is about. You know what I mean? So it's like, I'm like, nah, I don't care about the dollar or the, you know, the 500 subscribers. It's a great concept. But I'm like, I'll build something else for that, you know, that makes more sense. But yeah, you're right. It's like, it's weird that we're in, there's, maybe it's because there's so much, it's so saturated that we just can only have like a finite amount of spectrum to see what we can get on.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, I mean, the internet really changed it to where I don't think that there really is that much more content now. Well, there is. But the difference is now that you can find it thanks to the internet.
Right.
Whereas back before, you know, the 2000s, it's like you couldn't upload your own videos on YouTube, or no, there wasn't a, you know, a centralized database of streaming music like Spotify or Apple Music to where everyone can upload their music. So it's just like now you get also into a lost sea of content. Whereas, like, you never would have been able to hear the singer, songwriter, artist from Austin, Texas, and hear their music, you know, 20 years ago, unless you were in Austin, Texas and you saw them perform at a venue.
Right.
Where now I can look up, you know, 1,000 different artists that all live in Austin, Texas, and stream everything I want to, you know, here in Los Angeles.
Well, and
you know,
also, so one of the things that you mix all the Jam in the Van stuff. And yeah. You pick some really big artists like Gary Clark Jr., Marcus King. Rattle off some other people that you've mixed with that project.
Sublime with Rome, Eagles of Death Metal, Tower of Power. I mean, there's so many. I'm just trying to remember some of the bigger.
So many.
Blues Traveler. So many. Yeah, yep. I mean, there's definitely a bunch of fun people. And I've mixed so many bands with them that I've stopped counting. And well, I mean, that, like,
it's cool because it's become like a part of what you do.
Yeah.
A big part is like mixing live stuff. So it's like,
yeah.
It was one of the reasons I was like, Sean, you're my live guy all the time. And, you know, we're doing other projects too. But what's really interesting is like, I see why you're great at this. It's like, it's definitely a part of like, you know, what you do is making all these videos sound so good. And they do.
Yeah, and I definitely appreciate that. And a lot of it, I think, is also just the reason why I am, you know, very good at mixing live stuff is just because I've done so much of it, you know. Right. And I think that's also something that's really important that everyone should just remember with anything. It's like people ask me, it's like, how do I get good at mixing or producing or whatever, you know, writing music? It's like, well, how much are you doing it right now? Well, not that much. I'm more sitting around contemplating the best way to figure out how to do it. It's like, no, just start doing it. You're going to suck at it. I guarantee you. But like, after you do it for so many hours, you're going to get better. You kind of just have to at some level, you know? And so that's like the big thing with me mixing live stuff. And I've kind of created a niche for me doing live stuff. And a lot of it is because, and I also really enjoy it too. Every time I find a new tool that I can use in the live things to make things sound better, it's just like, this is great. I can, you know, get it to sound even cleaner or do different things with her. Or, you know, just like the concept. It's a lot of fun for me because there's a lot of problem solving with it.
Well, I'm going to give you a huge compliment, too, because, like, the Sight and Sound project with, you know, episode one especially, you know, with getting John Primer, I remember what the energy was like in the room. And it was just, I mean, it was palpable. There was, like, magic in the room just with his presence alone. And it was very old school. Like, there was nothing new school about it. And when you mixed it, it was like seeing something in Cadillac Records. I mean, Chess Records, and very throwback to the Chicago scene. And I was like, so thankful that you took that approach, because now I watch it and I'm like, and that's what I'm getting. I'm getting so much feedback from people like, this sounds so great. And I'm like, yes. And it's so like, it doesn't make John Primer sound like a pop star. You know what I mean? Like, which is not what you want John Primer to sound like. You want him to sound like an old blues cat that can play and sing the way he does. Let's play that, because I don't want to run out of time. We're going to play, this is Sight and Sound. We just debuted the first performance last Friday. This is John Primer with the NK Power Trio and Bob Coratore, so singing 40 Days and 40 Nights.
Today, our special guest is Grammy-nominated artist John Primer. John was one of Muddy Waters' last guitarists and a blues artist you should know about. Welcome to episode one of Sight and Sound. There's nothing like a studio, and I've been singing in them since I was a kid. From singing on movie soundtracks with Luther Vandross to movie scores with Danny Elfman to recording albums with my two bands, studios represent a type of magical experience like no other. Here we are at the Sauce Pot in San Luis Obispo, and what's about to unfold I just couldn't put into words. And as you know, when words fail, music speaks. What do you get when you take two of your bands in different combinations and add a special guest to the mix? You get a live recorded music series that's been a dream of mine for years in the making. I've been a touring artist for over two decades, and whether I'm in a studio or out performing at clubs and festivals, music always is the magic that brings me home. My name is Nikhil Karula, and this is Sight and Sound. Here's the NK Power Trio with John Primer singing 40 Days and 40 Nights, one of Muddy Waters' classic songs.
40 Days, 40 Nights, take three, let's do it.
One, two, three, 40 days, 40 nights. Just don't know.
hope she will come back home tonight.
Ain't nothing but chicken wing with hot sauce.
Now you're making me hungry.
Got to put hot sauce on it, man, to feel it.
So good. And you know what's funny? It's like all these channels, they got millions of streams, and they got even more subscribers. We only have 240 subscribers. We got double the amount of streams. So I'm like, we will get there to the millions and build this. But we have so many cool episodes and things that are happening. And Sean, thank you for being a part of this. Where can people find you if they want to find you on Instagram, ask you big stuff? Where can they find you online?
I'm pretty simple. My website is seanpjones.net, www.seanpjones.net. And my Instagram handle is just search for Sean P. Jones and it'll be the first one that pops up. So I'm pretty easy, just my full name.
Well, I'm excited. We got a lot of cool projects coming up. We got a lot of cool music coming up, new episodes on Sight and Sound. I know you're going to be working on tons of other stuff too. But, man, thanks for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood again, welcoming back. I like that you were like, yo, can we do it remotely? I'm like, of course, dude, because I only want to do these remotely now. It's like, I get it. You know, it's hard. It's hard to get me out of the house.
Yeah, exactly. And I just want to thank you for I don't know if you purposefully did it or not, but you gave me one of my favorite compliments ever, which is that I can be, you know, true and helpful to the music of whatever style of music I'm doing, which is to me the most important thing on anything I work on, because I don't want to just be, you know, one of those producers or engineers that does his thing and doesn't give the music credit of whatever it is, you know. So whether I'm working on blues, hip hop, or pop, or classical music, of like honoring that music as opposed to just like trying to, for a better term, shit all over my stuff all over it, which never turns out well.
And you know what's funny? Like, I don't know if you've seen Cadillac Records, but when they play this song, like one of the engineers is like, man, we can't have a harmonica just playing over the track over the whole time. And he's like, but listen to this. This is like, it sounds so great. So like what they really wanted to do was bring that harmonica down just so it's present enough. And we did that. And it's like, you get the harmonica and then it comes up. I'm like, man, we did what they wanted to do on that recording. And it's so apparent, but it's so awesome. And it's also makes it new and still true to the characteristics of what it is. So yeah, man, I'm just happy that we're making music together and doing some cool stuff. And I look forward to so much more. There's so much music coming out, man. So but yeah, man, thanks for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. This was a great way to end it because we got some exciting new stuff, new videos coming out. Check out seanpjones.net to find out if Sean can mix your track. We'll see you guys next week. On behalf of Sean, myself, and Sam, take care of each other. Take care of yourselves. Peace and love, people. Peace and love.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.